Welcome, everyone. We are now beyond 125 days into one of the most barbaric campaigns of genocide the world has ever witnessed. Israel, backed by the West, including the U.S. and U.K., has unleashed a criminal crusade of aggression against Palestinians of the besieged Gaza Strip. And every rule of engagement violated, every war crime committed, and all the values of humanity breached. And now there are many hopes of a ceasefire could put an end to a nightmare that's claimed nearly 28,000 Palestinian lives, over 13,000 of which have been children. Today, we'll bring dimensions of this potential ceasefire into our spotlight. Joining us for the program is Amal Wahdan, human rights activist and political analyst, joining us from Ramallah. And Ali Rizk, journalist and political analyst, joining us from Beirut. I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Amal, we're going to start with you in occupied Ramallah. Amal, now we know there's this the ceasefire proposal that's calling for 3 45-day phases and will involve a stop to the fighting, the delivery of aid, a captive exchange, reconstruction efforts, and complete Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. Now the U.S. says it's optimistic about this deal. The Qatari and the Egyptian mediators, they like it. But the Israeli prime minister doesn't. Why? I mean, does the regime demands have to be as disproportionate when it comes to this ceasefire as this campaign of genocide has been thus far?
Actually, it's not a surprise that the war cabinet, the Israeli war cabinet, has been skeptical about this proposition by the Palestinian resistance. Actually, Netanyahu has declared his opposition to this deal yesterday when he said that he's going to continue with the war until he meets all the goals that were set forward, which is disarmament of Hamas continue to occupy some parts of the Gaza Strip. There is no talk about ceasefire that would lead to a political solution. Of course, they are. This government is against the political solution. It's against the two-state solution, though the two-state solution doesn't meet the aspirations of the Palestinian people. The majority of the Palestinian people actually refuses this two-state solution. So what we have in front of us is a government that is determined on one thing only, that they want to release the prisoners, the Israeli soldiers prisoners, from the hands of the resistance, the Palestinian resistance. And they want to continue controlling Gaza. Actually, Gaza was not liberated, as we think, or as the world might think. It was under siege, under blockade for 17 years. And the 2005 withdrawal from the Israeli direct occupation did not mean that it was a free territory. They were under not only siege, they cannot have any connection with the outside world. And they had been, there no connection with the West Bank even, or with 1948 territories. So Gaza's situation was actually under occupation. So this talk about the ceasefire and about the negotiations, Blinken visit to the area is not going to bring anything forward unless they exert, the U.S., I mean, exert some pressure or real pressure. The question here is whether the U.S. is ready to exert some pressure at this radical and terrorist government or no. Actually, if the U.S. administration was against this war.
I don't mean to cut you off, Amal. I want to come actually back to you to speak about the U.S. and Antony Blinken and what their so-called policy is on all of this. But let me welcome Mr. Ali Rizk to the program real quick. I don't mean to be rude and cut you off. I'm going to come right back to you. Ali, welcome to the program. Now, Ali, to Amal's point, I mean, the regime's premier, Benjamin Netanyahu, he says we're only several months away from achieving victory in Gaza when asked about this ceasefire. I mean, do you think he is referring to putting an end to Hamas, as he's been saying all along, him and his cabinet, or to what this may sound like to a lot of people, is that he means an end to Gaza, the Gaza that we know it, the way it's been thus far, to Amal's point?
Look, I think that Netanyahu's statements, you have to remember that Netanyahu is leading the most right-wing government in Israeli history. So I think that some of those statements no doubt are related to the fact that you have these right-wing figures like Smotrich and Ben-Gavir who represent the right-wing settlers, if you would like. And he has to satisfy them, otherwise his government will fall. So I don't think that his statements yesterday necessarily mean that a categorical rejection of the proposal. I think we have to be cautious in that regard. I'm not, you know, entirely optimistic about a ceasefire or a truce or whatever you want to call it, a stop to the fighting from being reached. But I'm at the same time, I don't think that you could completely rule out that some kind of a ceasefire is going to be reached. To my information, an Israeli delegation is heading to Cairo. A Hamas delegation is also heading to Cairo. So those visits, this diplomatic flurry, if you would like, points out that something is, you know, continuing, that the chances are still alive. They're not completely dead. The U.S., it's true that it's not putting real pressures on the Netanyahu government as of yet for domestic reasons related to the fears on the part of the Biden administration that the pro-Israeli lobby will attack him and that would undermine his chances for re-election. But a very important development happened in the past few days was a stance issued by Saudi Arabia when they said that we won't normalize ties with Israel unless the fighting in Gaza comes to a stop. That was a very, very important issue because the Biden administration is pinning its hopes on Saudi-Israeli normalization. Now, I think that the main development we have to await is, will this Saudi stance push the Americans into exerting more pressure on Netanyahu, and will this development indeed make Netanyahu himself change his behavior? Because one of the achievements he always brags about is that, look, under my premiership or my time as prime minister, we normalize with the UAE, we normalize with other countries. Normalizing with Saudi Arabia would be considered to be a jackpot for him. So this development does potentially, possibly, I'm not saying it's certain, but it might possibly change the calculations and push Netanyahu towards seizing the fight again. It might not come under the title ceasefire, it might come under the title truce, whatever, but maybe a halt to the fighting. I think that still remains possible in the near future.
Thank you, Ali. And Amal, you were referring to the fact that Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, since October 7th, has been out to the region a handful of times. But it seems every time he comes out, whether before he leaves Washington, he talks about the unacceptable civilian death toll, the Israelis have a right to defend themselves, or, you know, basically he's called it everything but genocide, asked that he's going to come out here and push for possibly a ceasefire. But yet every time he's come and he's left, it seems like the Israelis unleashed a new dimension, a whole new myriad of war crimes against the Palestinians. So it begs the question, what's going on? Is this political theater by Washington, or is there genuine concern there and a push for a real ceasefire?
Yeah, well, the thing is, Blinken has said or repeated most of the time that he was only focusing on releasing the hostages, as he called them. This is his main concern. He doesn't give a damn about the 6,000 Palestinian political prisoners that are under the captive of the Israeli authorities, occupation authorities. And he doesn't mention the 7,000 prisoners who were arrested after October 7th. So most of the time he focuses on one thing and one thing only. If they are that concerned about the human casualties, the Palestinian lives that has been taken all through this, over 27,000 martyrs, more than 68, and displaced. In Rafah alone, there is 11 people who were displaced from north, middle, and Khan Yunis area, while Rafah itself is only 200 has only 250,000 Palestinians. The human situation in the Gaza Strip is very dire. In North Gaza, there is 300,000 people who are starving to death. The Americans do not care about human Palestinian human lives. They care only about their military base here, which is the colonial settler regime in Palestine. That's their main concern, and they don't want to lose this footstep in this area. So that's their own concern. Otherwise, why would they provide the colonial regime with ammunition all the time? Why would they provide them with financial aid, with political and diplomatic cover-up? So the Palestinians know for sure that the Americans are complicit in this genocide crimes against the Palestinians, and this would not change the fact on the ground. And we have the resistance that changed the whole equation here, and the Palestinians, when the Palestinian resistance put forward a proposition, and I don't think that they will lean back. There is no negotiations. They have discussed this with other factions, with other resistance group, and they came up with this proposition. And this will not change. I don't think that we are going to see a real solution, ceasefire coming soon, unless the Israelis go through real loss in lives and economy.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Ali, I'd like you to weigh in on what Amal was saying. If the U.S. is really concerned, and Blinken's been out here supposedly this time around that he's come out, he's gone into Tel Aviv, and he's tried to approach this far-right cabinet, pushing, saying that Washington wants this ceasefire to really work this time. Yet, supposedly, this is all reported by Israeli media, that his pleas have been falling on deaf ears with this far-right cabinet that you're referring to. So he's had to approach supposedly centrists and the Benny Gantz and their so-called war cabinet. So my question to you, and Amal said this really well, that if they are really this concerned, why are you shopping Tel Aviv for a ceasefire? All you have to do is withhold the two $14 billion plus packages that you're providing the regime to carry out its campaign of genocide, and possibly you'll get results and get everyone listening.
Again, you have to look at the strength. You have to look at the domestic policies in the U.S. Israel is a case. Israel is not just an American foreign policy issue. It's one of those cases where it's a foreign policy issue and a domestic policy issue due to the strength of the pro-Israeli lobbies in the U.S. Biden, according to his calculations, as it seems, is not ready to enter onto a collision course with the Israeli government for a simple fact, or one of the facts is that, as I said before, this would undermine his chances for being re-elected. Republicans are already accusing him. In fact, Ben-Gavir, the Israeli far-right minister, in an interview with Wall Street Journal, if you saw that interview, he said that Trump would be better for Israel than Biden would be. So even the Israelis are playing on these domestic political issues in the U.S. That, according to Biden's perspective, makes it very difficult for him to make really or to take really tangible action against the Israelis. And you have to add to that the fact that Biden, to begin with, is a very pro-Israeli figure. He's said it time and again that you don't have to be a Jew to be a Zionist. So his pro-Israeli credentials are well known. So I think you have several factors now which would make it very unlikely that the American administration would put real pressure on the Israeli government. You see that America's being dragged into a regional war. It's just about, you know, it hasn't reached a war in the traditional sense, but you see what's happening in Syria and Iraq, where there are acts of war taking place, the assassination of a leader in the Kataib Hezbollah, Iraq, the strikes which the Americans are launching against Yemen and the counter-strikes against the American and British ships. This all calls for America to indeed put a, you know, take tangible measures, because a ceasefire in Gaza would make all of this come to a stop. But it hasn't. And that just shows you how concerned the Americans are regarding, or how the White House is so concerned about the domestic political calculations, and at the same time how it supports Israel to this extent. But once again, I go back to the Saudi stance. The Saudi stance, because the American administration has pinned so much hope on the normalization, the Saudi condition of not normalizing before a ceasefire in Gaza, that may push the situation a bit forward and make the Americans exert more pressure on the Israelis. It's not guaranteed, but it might be that impetus which is required to push things in that way.
And how much do you think that weighs in on things, Amal, that the Saudi factor at this point in the ceasefire talks?
The Americans has also to be pressured. I mean, the whole area here has been on fire since the beginning of what they call the Arab Spring. Now, with the axis of resistance uniting together in different parts of this area, the only demand that they have that the U.S. should leave this area. They should leave Iraq, they should leave Syria, and they should get out of this area. And I can see that the pressure has been put against U.S. forces in Iraq and Syria by the Iraqi resistance. And the situation in the Red Sea, and that I think the Americans has to be pressured to leave the country, to leave this area. And if they do, the Israelis eventually will lean back.
All right, Ali, I'm going to come back to you. So how do you think Benjamin Netanyahu, we know right now, with his political and legal challenges, that a lot of people feel it weighs in on how he's approaching, how he's approached it since October 7th, and how he's going to continue to approach this campaign of genocide and a potential ceasefire. A lot of people feel the same with U.S. President Joe Biden, that their political standing, his right now record low popularity right now, and possibly going up against a gaining in popularity Donald Trump, should he stand for the Republican nomination, which it seems like he will, that all of this may weigh in on the fate of a ceasefire in Gaza. How do you see that?
Well, look, regarding Netanyahu, I think that the accountability which he might face as a result of the corruption charges and other issues. This, I believe, is one factor in his wishes to prolong the war, but it's just one. I think there's another factor which isn't mentioned often, is the fact that the Israeli society in general has shifted very much to the right. And that is manifested in the presence of members of cabinet like Smotrich and Ben-Gavir. The fact that you have a very far-right Israeli government, the most far-right in history, shows that the Israeli society has become very far-right. And so when Netanyahu, as we saw in his remarks yesterday, when he continues to talk about the goal of eliminating Hamas and tries to make the statement or to claim that they've made significant gains against Hamas, this is all addressed to an Israeli society which is the majority of it. I know there are some segments which are not considered to be right-wing, but the high majority of it are those right-wing racist figures. So that's, I think, another important factor we should bear in mind. Biden, as you mentioned, also has his own political dilemmas. He's trailing Trump, according to most opinion polls. And if he does put real pressure on Israel, like put conditions on military aid, etc., the Republican Party is going to be very quick on pouncing on that and taking advantage of it to show that he's weak against Israel, or he's too strong against Israel and weak against the resistance axis. In fact, the strikes which have taken place in Iraq and Syria and Yemen, despite the escalatory nature of military action, many of the pro-Republicans and some Republicans himself continue to label him as being too weak and try to push him and say that real action requires attacking Iran. People like the Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. So with that atmosphere, again, Biden appears to have his hands tied, but at the same time, he risks alienating, and I think he has alienated already, the Arab American vote, people in Michigan and elsewhere, in swing states, which are considered to be pivotal in Biden's re-election campaign. So I think with all these factors in mind, I think that what Biden is trying to do is that he's not going to take any steps which could anger or backfire and make the pro-Israeli lobby launch a campaign against him. At the same time, he's trying to advocate for a ceasefire and talk about the necessity of allowing aid to enter in a way, or according to his hopes, that might keep or make the Arab Americans vote for him once again. I think those are Biden's calculations. But, you know, all of this makes it still quite difficult for a ceasefire to be reached if we were to focus on those considerations. But I still think in this particular round, in this latest round of talks in Paris, I still think that there does remain a chance to achieve something. It might not be a ceasefire. It could come under the name temporary truce or whatever. But there is a possibility, I think, for the intensity now of the violence to decrease.
But when you look at Netanyahu and his cabinet, their rhetoric hasn't changed, Ali. They're still talking about we will not let up until we end Hamas, until we finish Hamas. A lot of experts and analysts feel that even the Israelis know that they cannot put an end to Hamas, that Hamas is one resistance faction. There are many. It's an ideology. As long as there is occupation, there is going to be resistance. As long as there's ethnic cleansing, there is going to be resistance. As long as there's apartheid and marginalization of the Palestinian population, there will be resistance, whether you call it Hamas or whatever, that even the Israelis know this. It's just an excuse to try to prolong this thing. And maybe to your point, they might want to try to prolong it until they get a hawkish Republican in office to see if they can take Gaza completely away from Palestinians, is what a lot of people feel at this point.
Incidentally, I'm not I don't agree very much with that opinion that if Trump comes to the White House, that would necessarily mean a more pro-Israeli policy. Remember, just quickly on this point, remember that Trump, in the last time around, he populated his cabinet or his government with very hawkish figures, people like Mike Pompeo, Mike Pence, James Mattis, very anti-Iranian figures. That doesn't necessarily have to be the case in the next cabinet, in the next government. Possibly Tucker Carlson, the well-known former Fox News host, he might be a cabinet figure for all we know. And we know that he was very much against the military action against Iran and very much against what Trump did, the attack which led to the death of the martyr, General Qasem Soleimani.
Thank you, Ali. Always a pleasure to have you on and pick your mind on things. I want to thank you both for joining us on the program. Amal Watan, human rights activist and political analyst, joining us from Occupied Ramallah, and Ali Risk, their journalist and political analyst, joining us from Beirut. And that brings us to the conclusion of this segment of your Spotlight. Thank you for tuning in. Bye-bye for now.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Back to Reality. Well, this is Asma. Once more, I have the pleasure to be your host in here. And here with me, I have two very dear guests, Brother Hassanain and Sister Bita. Welcome.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having us.
Assalamu alaikum, dear sister, brother, and listeners. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, wa alaikum assalam, both of you.
I am Bita, and I'm studying medicine at one of the universities in Tehran.
I'm Hassanain, and I'm studying in a Hawza, and I'm pursuing Islamic sciences from the Islamic Seminary Qom.
So, wish you both a lot of luck. To tolerate difficult situations in life is not always the easiest thing to be done. And most of the times, the way we come to define sadness, we use our most depressing words in our word hoards to explain about sadness. And those moments in which you feel like the entire world is just collapse over your head. Are there any goods in sadness, according to you, brother?
You know, like, if we look opportunities and everything, like, even in sadness, we can find something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, our souls elevates, you know, when we go through hardships.
Yeah.
Going through sufferings and trials, you know, our soul elevates. So, you know, it's actually a test from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Do you say that to yourself when you're at the moment of that sadness?
Yes, I do.
And does it really work?
It works,
at
yeah.
that moment.
Yeah,
at
you know,
the heart of
actually,
those hardships.
Actually, the fact of this being, you know, as a test from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you know, and it will go away. This thing helps me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything, you know, like sadness and sufferings and trials, I believe is a phase of life.
Yeah, they're temporary.
Yeah, they're temporary. So you just need to be patient during that time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you think it this way, you know, it actually helps me, you know, and however I act in
but
this
you
particular...
must come to that understanding.
Exactly, yeah. Like, yeah. That's the first step, actually.
Yes.
But when you come to this understanding and the fact that you'll be getting closer to Allah subhanahu mm-hmm. wa ta'ala with these means, you know, it helps you a lot.
But not all people have the same perspective of sadness.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When something so harsh gets in the middle of the setting of your life, then your first reaction is undefinable.
Actually, it happened to me that one of my friends asked me about why we think like sadness is something good or something like that. And I told her, like, whenever you are sad, you can evaluate the times of your happiness. And she answered me that, for example, when you eat ice cream itself is delicious. It doesn't mean that, for example, something bitter that you ate before that mm-hmm. is making it more delicious. And it was really shocking for me to hear to this logic that, okay,
well,
it doesn't mean...
Well, that analogy is not going to make the whole story.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And I still believe that if you are right and you mean, okay, these two things are completely separated, mm-hmm. then you shouldn't have this background mindset about sadness that is something bad.
Uh-huh.
I mean, who said bitterness is not delicious? And it's exactly the same about sadness.
Yeah.
I mean, you are making it more complicated than what it is. You need that sadness.
Well, I'm not sure that's the thing we should say to someone who's lost their dear one and then they're coming to you and asking you about sadness.
Yeah, for sure.
You know what I mean? Because the situation is different. In real life, sadnesses are just...
reminders.
So bitter.
And reminders.
Of course they're reminders. But you know, you come to understand they're reminders when you are way... far from them. You know, you have set them aside.
So this is the whole point.
They are past. When they are past, yes, you can say, okay, it was a lesson and I am now evolved into a better version of myself. But at that moment, nobody knows how I felt, how I reacted, and how I used to think in my personal zone.
You know, I believe that, you know, getting in the zone of sadness is not always in our hands.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes the situations, you know, losing a loved one.
Yeah.
Or any type of, like, you know,
it's
other
not
situations.
Always self-imposed. Sometimes it's imposed by nature, by destiny, whatever.
Yeah. So it's not always in our hands, right? But getting out of this zone is our hands.
Yeah, it's your choice.
You know, because, you know, you're sad regarding something. So, you know, until when?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, this makes you actually depressed. Like, this makes you get into depression.
Yeah.
So sometimes there reaches a certain point that you need to force yourself out of the zone.
Yeah, and that needs too much of a strength, I suppose.
And sometimes this method will lead you to self-denial, unfortunately.
Yeah,
because
that's
you try so hard to
look at it,
to, you know, to be out of this situation that you cannot even accept that you are in this situation.
Yes, you don't embrace the truth.
Yeah, exactly.
You just try to escape from it.
And because of that, I feel like sometimes it's okay that you
go through a phase
depressed
zone. Sometimes I think it's good for you.
Yeah, and it's okay to cry.
Yeah, that's why when people lose their dear ones, usually the other people tell them, okay, let them cry.
Exactly.
That process,
relaxes your heart. Like, you know, it makes you feel light.
Yeah, but then again, I'm telling you, sadness is not an easy topic to go through because it's so deep, then words are just... not enough to explain what is going on in the heart of a person who is going through that sadness. And right now, since it has become so dark, let's go for a short break and then we will be back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
We're talking about sadness and happiness, how we define them, why we usually put that sadness aside and we attack it like it's all the bad things in the world, while we forget about the fact that sadness is meant to be also in the way of our perfection. It's helping us to grow more and more. Without the sadness, we cannot even have a better understanding of our happy moments.
You know what? We're living in a world that pleasure is everything. If you are pleased to do that, it is beneficial for you to do that, then it's okay. Do it.
Yeah.
And if it's not, then omit it. Delete it. Because there is no obligation on you to do anything. And there is another theory that when you have a lot of choices and options to choose, your process of choosing something is more difficult.
Of course.
The more happiness that we are facing and we are going through, the more sadness is deep in our heart.
Okay, you must come to this understanding that suffering is also a tool for your development. You must come to that understanding,
yeah,
but not necessarily that is the thing that happens in real life.
Why do we get sad? Like, the different origins of sadness, right?
So something is important for us. When we feel that danger is attacking it, we feel sad.
Okay, so different origins, and these origins are like just two possibilities. Like, you know, when something's not going according to us, we are sad, right?
Yeah.
So the two possibilities over here is that, like, either we can compensate this or we cannot. So, you know, I scored less. Okay, so maybe next time I'll study harder and get good grades.
Yeah, this one is easy to cope up
so,
with.
So, yeah, until I do not compensate it, the chances that I'm going to remain sad. So, you know, it lies in my hands.
Mm-hmm.
But for the ones, like, you know, they cannot be compensated. You know, they are a bit difficult. But not for the believers. Not for the mu'mineen. Not
That's
for the believers.
The point.
You know, when you lose your loved one, when you lost maybe someone, you know, lost their grandparents, like, mm-hmm. you know, may Allah bless all of them.
Yeah.
So if someone loses his grandfather, grandmother, or maybe someone, a friend or anyone,
yeah, a friend even.
Yeah, so it's you cannot get your friend back.
Exactly.
You cannot get your father back. For the believers, it's easier for them to get out of this.
And I guess you must have been doing some precautionary things before this. Like, for example, you must strengthen your connection with Allah for these days.
You know, you feel sad whenever you lose something or whenever you can't achieve something.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a specific form of sadness, which I love it, which is the sadness of realizing the time that you realize the truth of life, the time that you realize the truth of time, mm-hmm. the truth of afterlife, the truth of love, everything. And this process of realizing everything, you know, has a specific deep sadness in itself.
In psychology, there are different phases to a mental development of a person or individual.
Yeah.
One of them is the stage, the real stage. Like we have imaginary stage, symbolic stage, and then we have the real. And then this real is something that we do not have a grasp of it. We do not understand it. Nobody, for example, like death belongs to the realm of real. We do not have any specific idea about what's going on in death, but there are some moments in life in which you're sitting in your place, perhaps you're reading something, watching a movie, anything, a dialogue, a short sentence, anything, would take you away from your real life temporarily, momentarily. Just for a moment, you feel like you are no longer the same person you were the moment before. In that moment, you come to grasp the real. You are linked to that real, which is unknown to you.
Exactly.
For just a moment. All of these things happen unconsciously. Sadness is the same thing. Sometimes we read a poem or we watch a sad movie. And then something happens in us. It works as a revolution.
Yeah.
That sadness, I am with you. I agree. That sadness really develops you.
So, you know, it's actually the best feeling in the world. Like, you know, it relaxes your soul.
Yeah, you know, you feel actually, like you're lighter.
It actually helps me to get out of the worldly sadness.
Yeah.
For this sadness, it's an exception. Like, you know, it cannot be compared to any other sorrow.
Because it feels like purgation. It feels as if you're letting go of all the bad stains that have got into your heart.
Unfortunately, absolute science always, for example, tells that emotions are something as a mechanism, evolutionary mechanism for you. But I believe emotions, specifically sadness, is a reflection of your soul.
Yeah.
So you have to love it and value it.
You know, at least embrace it.
Yeah.
Not all these sadnesses are going to destroy you. Some of them are. And it's the same way as we look at death. Look, like many people, the first thing that it would come to their mind, speaking of death, would be dark pictures, dark images, the black outfits, and whatever sad comes to their mind. But when you come to think of death as the other stage of your life, the one that is eternal, the one that is without any pain, the one that is getting close to your Lord, the one that you have always been worshiping, right now is much more closer to you. You're satisfied with him. He's satisfied with you. If you look at it from this perspective, then death is going to be more tolerable for you. When you think of it, you're not going to feel like afraid or scared.
Exactly.
The same thing could be applied to sadness. If you look at sadness as a stage of your development, as something which is the sister of happiness, as something which could be going the same way with happiness, like we have it in the Holy Book of Quran. إِنَّمَا الْعُسْرِ يُسْرًا. So if you believe in this, that after all these sadnesses, after all the difficulties, there's going to be a phase in which you're going to taste happiness and easiness, then everything is going to be much more easier for you. And you're not going to just attack sadness that much. You're going to look at it differently. So everything happens inside you.
So it's a chance for us to grow.
Exactly.
You know, and we should remember that Allah says in the Holy Quran that it does not burden a soul more than it can bear.
Exactly. So just change your mind and mentality. Try to look at things differently. Deconstruct your old conceptions of things that bother you and try to create new ones. New ones that are more applicable with your own way of looking at
situation.
Life.
Yeah, situation and emotionally.
Exactly. Yeah, being flexible is a talent and it could help you a lot throughout your life. So thank you. Thank you for staying with us. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Pakistan has held a parliamentary elections to choose the new prime minister and members of the country's parliament along with four provincial assemblies. The polling, which started at 8 in the morning, continued until 5 in the evening without any break. Over 128 million registered voters across the country cast their ballots for a record 17,816 candidates of both national and provincial assembly seats.
Elections in Pakistan are absolutely crucial, especially during times of economic crisis. As a nation, we are grappling with significant economic challenges, and it's through the electoral process that we have the opportunity to bring about change.
By casting our votes, we can choose leaders who have the vision, capability, and dedication to implement policies that will lead to economic recovery and prosperity.
At least 12 people, including 10 security officials, were killed in separate incidents of violence, while the internet and mobile phone services remained suspended on election day.
Preliminary election results indicate that independent candidates backed by Imran Khan's PTI party managed to secure victory. However, Nawaz Sharif, the former prime minister, is anticipated to be a contender for a fourth term. Three times Pakistan's former prime minister Nawaz Sharif says that he is ready to serve the nation for the fourth time if elected.
We will try our best to overcome the challenges we are facing at the moment. We will provide relief to the masses at their doorsteps as we have promised during our election campaign. My party will also combat inflation.
Nawaz Sharif's political rival, ex-premier Imran Khan, who was overthrown by his opponents through a vote of no confidence in April 2022, is still behind bars for several convictions and is not allowed to run for office against his competitors. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The
The ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran in Syria, Dr. Hussein Akbari, held a press conference on Thursday at the Iranian embassy in Damascus for the occasion of the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. He discussed Iran's achievements in the past 45 years and its positions at regional and international levels.
As you know, we're currently commemorating the 45th anniversary of the glorious Islamic Revolution. This revolution emerged victorious under exceptional circumstances and stood against the two main ideologies of that time, imperialism and communism. The revolution presented a new discourse and enabled Iran to break free from Western American hegemony, refusing to submit to any other form of domination. Consequently, a global threat was formed against Iran.
Akbari highlighted the principles of the revolution on Iran's foreign policy to support justice and equality around the world. This put Iran under enormous pressure. Answering journalists' questions, he stressed that Tehran and Damascus share the same principles in supporting resistance against oppression.
The Islamic Revolution has been based on modern foundations and principles since its inception. Its initial slogans were that the Islamic Republic is neither Eastern nor Western. The second slogan focused on the liberation of the Palestinian people from Zionist occupation and the liberation of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Islamic Republic remained committed to this slogan, despite its high costs. No one stood beside the Islamic Revolution in Iran or supported it except for Syria, who believed that resistance is the right of all people.
The Iranian ambassador affirmed that no matter the pressures, the Islamic Republic will never change its principles and will always support the resistance movements until victory over the occupation. The Arab Writers Union also held a forum that highlighted the achievements and impacts of the Islamic Revolution, not only in Iran, but also at the regional and international levels. The participants talked about how the Islamic Revolution has solidified the culture of resistance as well as fighting for the liberation of all nations. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
It was vindication on all counts. In one of the most closely monitored employment tribunal cases of recent memory, Professor David Miller and his legal team successfully claimed unfair dismissal and discrimination based on his philosophical belief that Zionism is inherently racist, imperialist, and colonial. In a high-profile case, Professor Miller was dismissed by Bristol University in October 2021 after a campaign of relentless harassment by pro-Zionists.
So what it means is that, first of all, I was wrongfully dismissed by the university. They didn't properly investigate the complaints against me, and they didn't properly evaluate what they should do with the results of that investigation. Second of all, the court determined that my anti-Zionist views are protected under law, and it's illegal to discriminate against someone who has anti-Zionist views. And they determined that the university had, contrary to what they said, actually dismissed me because of my anti-Zionist views. So that was the key finding. And of course, that's a protection going forward for every person in the UK in employment who is attacked by their employer or by the Zionist movement, that they cannot be sacked for having anti-Zionist views.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson.
Former parliamentarian Chris Williamson, himself a victim of pro-Zionist hounding, responded to the verdict.
Well, I'm absolutely delighted for David personally, but this is a landmark case and will cause huge ramifications, I think, for other people who have been targeted by the Zionist lobby. And many people have been threatened with their employment. Others have lost employment as a result of their support for the Palestinian people. And so now we've got it established in law that opposition to Zionism is a protected characteristic under the Equalities Act.
A statement from the lawyers representing Professor Miller in this case reads, in part,
"This is a landmark case and marks a pivotal moment in the history of our country for those who believe in upholding the rights of Palestinians. The timing of this judgment will be welcomed by many who at present are facing persecution at their workplaces for speaking out against the Israeli crime."
In the face of the unrelenting genocide taking place in Gaza, pro-Palestinian voices are under increased pressure to remain silent. Professor Miller's victory could make workplaces safer for Palestinian advocates.
The position we were in was I made what are fairly unexceptional anti-Zionist points in my public comments. Now, to Zionist seers, these are unconscionable, outrageous things to say. Zionism is racism, Zionism is colonial, Zionism will always be racist. And the Zionists don't like that, and so they want to show that that is somehow anti-Semitism or some kind of slur on Jewish people. And of course, it's not, but that's what they wanted to show. But what the court has determined is that those unexceptional anti-Zionist statements are, in fact, unexceptional anti-Zionist statements, and that everybody can make those kinds of statements without fear.
Professor Miller's staunch pro-Palestinian views, including his work here on Palestine Declassified, made him a target for the pro-Zionist mob. Now, perhaps his victory at tribunal level will serve as an inspiration for those hoping to raise their voices for Palestine. Professor Miller's legal team will now be seeking the maximum compensation on offer for the losses and hurt caused by the discrimination suffered. Amina Taylor, London.
In response to recent US and UK airstrikes against Yemen, the country's armed forces have carried out a naval operation targeting American and British vessels.
The naval forces of the Yemeni army carried out two military operations in the Red Sea, the first targeting an American ship, Star Nasia, and the other targeting a British ship, Morning Tide. Both ships were targeted with appropriate naval missiles, and the hits were accurate and direct.
Sari added the Yemeni armed forces will carry out more qualitative military operations against all hostile American and British targets and the Red and Arab Seas. He said Sana reserves the right to respond to the US-UK aggression against Yemen. Military experts said this operation proves that the Yemeni army is capable of handling more than one target simultaneously. They added that the targeted vessels were carrying military equipment to Israel.
This is the first military operation in which we target two ships at the same time, an American and a British one. And this is to confirm our ability to deal with more than one target simultaneously. And any attempt by the enemy to camouflage its ships at sea will fail. We can identify its ship. Both ships or one of them were carrying military equipment heading to the ports of occupied Palestine to support the Israeli enemy.
Recently, the US and UK have intensified their strikes against Yemen, specifically targeting residential areas in Hodeidah City in a failed attempt to undermine the Yemeni army's capabilities and halt Yemen's naval operations. The Yemeni army has repeatedly affirmed that it will only cease its operations when Israel halts its genocidal war in Gaza.
Despite the continued attacks on Yemen by the US and UK, Yemen's army is expanding its naval operations in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, indicating that Western aggression has failed to affect the Yemeni army's capabilities. It has also vowed to confront Western escalation with broader operations targeting their interests in the region. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
In the Nigerian capital, Abuja, Muslim women and girls have held a conference on hijab, claiming that women are still persecuted and discriminated against for having hijab in the country. This is despite a Supreme Court ruling which established the use of hijab as a fundamental human right. One of the speakers at the conference explained that wearing the hijab is a religious obligation for Muslim women who have been directed to cover their bodies. She said it is therefore unacceptable for any discrimination against women on account of having hijab.
Sometimes the non-Muslims see hijab as a kind of barrier or as a kind of something that is anti-national development, feeling that Muslims are trying to show that they are Muslim is exclusive. But the truth of the matter, we all know that what we are trying to protect is the morality of the society. So the moment a lady wears hijab, it means she's being protected from the predatory eyes of the men.
The Coalition of Nigerian Muslim Women also staged an outreach in a park in Abuja where they engaged both Muslims and Christians, explaining the benefits of the hijab. Many women and girls were offered free pieces of headscarf, veils, and were taught how to tie them.
In a public park, you have different set of people, different faith, and different characters. So we feel that Islam is a religion for the universe, and then we need to share with everybody. And then this hijab being a very controversial issue in Nigeria, especially in our institution of higher learning and even in some few government establishments, we feel that we need to be here.
The group of Muslim women have insisted that everyone should understand that the hijab emphasizes the dignity, confidence, modesty, protection, and respect for females. They said the hijab is neither a symbol of the oppression of women nor an act of defiance against non-Muslims, and called on all Nigerians nursing this erroneous perception to stop in the interest of peaceful coexistence and respect for the law. Anjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Scientists working with special electron microscopes in order to undertake cutting-edge research and product development. This is nanotechnology, the integration of science and engineering on a tiny scale, namely with atoms and molecules. A relatively new field of science and technology with perceived long-term benefits. One that Iran has taken very seriously and today is reaping its rewards. This is all in line with long-term goals and 3-10-year plans to develop nanotechnology in Iran, with leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei's full support. But that is not enough. The main strategy of the Islamic Republic of Iran is to benefit from this cutting-edge technology. Therefore, according to officials at the Nanotechnology Development Headquarters, commercializing nano products is an important step and a top priority.
In 2001, which is pretty much the same time that other countries began to engage in nanotechnology development, we established a nanotech headquarters, and in many universities and research centers across the country, scientists started doing research in this field. We started with fewer than 10 scientists, but today there are more than 40,000 researchers and university professors working in this field in more than 150 nanotechnology research centers across the country.
Let me give you some statistics in order to explain what we mean by prioritizing. Right now, as we speak, we have commercialized 1,800 nanoproducts. More than 350 manufacturers have received nanotechnology production permits, and many laboratories are now equipped with or use nanotech devices and products. But the bad news is, in 2022, we sold over $1 billion worth of nanoproducts, and we earned $70 million from exports. Currently, 47 countries, including regional countries such as Iraq and Turkey, import nanoproducts made in Iran.
Advancements in a relatively new field of science, such as nanotechnology, is only one of the many achievements Iran has made after the Islamic Revolution, and definitely one that every single Iranian is proud of. Over the past two decades, the Islamic Republic of Iran has been able to gain a firm foothold in nanotechnology, today ranking among the world's top five in the field. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
The UK's first national demo since the International Court of Justice ruling on the Israeli regime's genocidal war on Gaza was another enormous gathering. People came from all over the UK. The sentiment here, very clearly, ceasefire now.
And I, for one, will not sit at home and watch this genocide played out on television. They said never again in 1948, but it is happening again, and it's a holocaust against the Gazans.
As with all the previous ones, this too was a broad spectrum of anti-war, pro-Palestinian sentiment, all here to push the government to act.
There is a sense here that international public opinion has had an impact. It's putting irresistible political pressure on the leaders here and around the world. And while the carnage continues, the calls for it to stop are growing louder.
In the run-up to the demo, an attempt by police to prevent it from finishing in Whitehall, the seat of government. Yet once again, people power prevailed. The UK government has been amongst the most hawkish pro-Israel states in the Western world, and the opposition Labour Party has not acted very differently with its purge of Israel critics from its ranks. Yet the Palestine Solidarity Movement in Britain has been the largest in Europe.
This is how we are showing those in power how we really feel. And how do we feel? We believe that a genocide is taking place in Palestine and that it is our government and our arms companies that are weaponizing that genocide and are profiteering from it.
A permanent ceasefire is yet to be achieved. But even if there were one tomorrow, organizers say, this movement isn't going away. The shift in public attitudes towards Palestine